Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. My name is Lauren Litton. I am the host of Spotlight on Youth, a radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. The show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking our guests questions live on air by dialing 347-994-1149. That is 347-994-1149. To indicate you have a question, press the number 1 on your telephone keypad, and you will be placed in the queue to be on the air. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose a question there. We have several interrelated issues we're discussing today. The show was originally going to focus solely on false and coerced confessions of minors, but less than a month ago, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Miller v. Alabama and Jackson v. Hobbs that the Eighth Amendment's prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment forbids a sentencing scheme that mandates life in prison without the possibility of parole for juvenile homicide offenders. This comes in a line of Supreme Court decisions favoring children, such as Roper v. Simmons, holding that the death penalty for youth violates the Eighth Amendment, and Graham v. Florida, ruling that youth sentenced for non-homicide offenses cannot receive life without parole. The justices have relied on three major differences between children and adults: immaturity, vulnerability, and the fact that a youth's character is not yet fully formed. The Supreme Court also recognized that juveniles react differently than adults to the legal process, which impacts their involvement and outcome in the juvenile and adult criminal justice systems. Therefore, we thought it would be a good time to revisit some of the research that supports those notions and then link it to false confessions and other relevant juvenile court processes. Joining us today is Dr. Antoinette Cavanaugh. Dr. Cavanaugh is a forensic clinical psychologist who has been in private practice since 1999, and she is an adjunct faculty member at Northwestern University School of Law. She consults with legal parties regarding forensic methods, preparing witnesses, and reviewing mental health documents. She conducts evaluations of youth and adults on a variety of forensic issues, including competence to comprehend Miranda rights, competence to stand trial, transfer to adult court, ability to form intent, disputed confessions, not guilty by reason of insanity, and mitigation. Dr. Cavanaugh testifies regularly at the state and federal level. She has served on various committees, including the American Psychological Association's Committee on Legal Issues, the Executive Committee of the American Psychology Law Society, where she also currently co-chairs their Minority Affairs Committee. She also consults with national organizations on issues related to juvenile justice and adolescent development. Dr. Cavanaugh earned her doctorate in clinical psychology from Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. She completed a fellowship in adolescent psychology at Cook County Hospital and a forensic psychology postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center. She served as the clinical director of the Juvenile Justice Division of the Cook County Juvenile Court Clinic, and was a clinical professor at Northwestern University School of Law for 10 years. So, Antoinette, welcome to the show. Well, it appears that we have lost our guest right now, and she may be in the process of calling back in. So I would ask for your patience. Thank you. wanted to let you know that we are still working on the issue right now. In the age of technology, this has never happened before. So, again, I appreciate your patience, and we will see if we can get Dr. Kavanaugh back into the show.
Hello.
Dr. Kavanaugh.
Hi there. I'm not sure what happened.
That's okay. You're live on air.
Okay.
I'm glad we were able to get you back on. So I was just welcoming you to the show after I did that lengthy introduction of you. It was very impressive.
Thank you.
And I was saying this has never happened before, so thank you for also hanging in there with us. So, as I indicated in the introduction, we're going to be talking about both adolescent brain science and false course confessions. And we often get to hear from the legal community on these issues, but it's great to have another professional viewpoint. So maybe you can take a moment from the personal side to explain, as a forensic clinical psychologist, how did you come to focus on these issues? What interests you about that?
I went into graduate school interested in adolescent development and adolescence. I was always fascinated by how adolescents and adults respond to the world differently, and they both feel the way they respond is correct. And then with development, adolescents sort of come to the side of seeing it as adults do, but it takes time. And so I've always been interested in that. With regard to false or disputed confessions, one of the first cases that I was involved in after graduate school was I was asked to evaluate a young man. He was about 19 at the time, and he was accused of killing his mother. And so I was asked to evaluate him to see if there were signs that it could be a false confession and if he understood his Miranda rights. And as part of my evaluation, I realized that he was suffering from schizophrenia and it hadn't been diagnosed. I was able to, it was clear in talking about what went on in the confession that some coercive tactics were used. Also, what he said happened didn't even line up with the evidence. And I also got to understand from him how the police tactics impacted him and how his failure to understand the legal system made him really vulnerable for signing a confession saying that he killed his mother. The week of trial, the state's attorney handed over evidence, DNA evidence, that determined that under her fingernails, she was the DNA of the person who actually killed her, who was someone who lived in their neighborhood, who was awaiting trial on other murders, because this man that I interviewed had been awaiting trial for 2 years. So he was released because then there was clear evidence that he did not do this. And then I worked with his legal team helping to assess what was the impact for him of that false confession when they then sued the city. And since then, because I'm in Chicago, I've had this amazing but sad opportunity to work on other cases where DNA has determined the person didn't do the offense, although they could have spent 20 years, 30 years, 40 years in prison, and trying to help understand what's the psychological consequence of these false confessions. So that's sort of a long-winded way of how I got into this.
Well, I'm really excited to have our show focus on that latter issue because we really have never talked about that before. But before we get there, as I indicated, the courts have increasingly recognized these differences between youth and adults, and so I don't know if there's anything more you wanted to add about the Supreme Court decisions, but also if you can build off what has been their impact on juvenile justice.
Okay. Unfortunately, as you know, I didn't hear your introduction where you talked about it, so I hope I'm not being repeating some of what you said, but I think the Miller case is fascinating because it really represents the fourth case in a series of cases in which the Supreme Court is saying we recognize based on science that adolescents and adults are not the same. We finally have really hard evidence. Sometimes the court sort of doesn't give as much credence as we'd like to psychology, but now through because we can take pictures of the brains as kids and adults are making decisions and actually see what parts of their brains light up, we see their brains really function differently. And I think that that has great impact for different arenas or for different people who work professionally and daily with kids. And I think that the Miller study really does look at that line of research and relies upon it to say how kids are different than adults and consequently in the legal arena should be treated differently.
Can you give us a little bit more detail about that research? You said that their brains function differently. How so?
Okay, so I'm just going to cite some studies. For example, we can there's a line of studies that have asked kids and I say kids, I mean from 10 to adults in their 30s to do a task. And then when they do this task, a risk task, which is you could do this, it's a video game, and you you want to do it and get through it as quickly as possible, but the more risk you take, you're going to be penalized for it. What we see, we can see two things in this line of research. One, adolescents, unlike adults, make riskier decisions when they're with their peers. But even when they're alone, they make riskier decisions. So it's this impact of peer pressure. So that's one thing. But when we put them in a functional, a machine that allows us to look at their brain, as they're doing this, what we see is that the adolescent part of the brain for adolescents that sort of, for lack of a better word, controls risk-seeking, reward-seeking, that part of the brain, that's more activated for an adolescent than it is for an adult. In contrast, the prefrontal lobe, the part of the brain that sort of allows you to put the brakes on things, think it through, think about the consequences, that part is barely active for an adolescent, but is very active for the adult. So what we see are these different parts of the brain being activated when you're doing the same task, but it causes you to make different decisions. And that's further impacted on whether or not your peers are there with you or even in the next room and you know that they're there.
So why does this research matter?
I think this research matters because, well, it matters in many ways. We've always, people who interact with adolescents daily often find themselves thinking, what was the adolescent thinking? Didn't they know this was going to happen? Couldn't they foresee these things? And this line of research says, well, no, not really. That's a skill that you need and that one develops as your brain develops and its functioning becomes more mature. So it matters because now we know that you might have a kid who looks like an adult, but as a class, adolescents aren't functioning like adults. So it allows us to understand their behavior, I think, in a more nuanced way. And in turn, as the laws are now changing, Miller being an example, it allows for adults to respond to them in a more nuanced way as well.
Okay, so we wanted to talk about one particular area where this research might matter, and it pertains to the confessions. What are some common misconceptions about Miranda rights, and are there differences in Miranda as applied to kids and adults? And maybe even for our audience, if we can step back and explain what Miranda rights are.
Okay, well, remember,
that's a lot.
I'm a non-lawyer. Yeah. Okay, so Miranda rights are the being informed of your constitutional rights, and you're supposed to be informed of those before a custodial interrogation so that ideally the person can weigh whether or not they want to give up those rights and talk to the police. And the law says this should be a thoughtful decision, and certain jurisdictions will allow parents to help the kid or will even say to the police, you must notify the parent, the idea being that the parent should be able to help them, although I think that that's a theoretical idea more than we actually see it. So that's sort of the role that Miranda rights are to have. People, you asked about misconceptions. People have a lot of misconceptions about Miranda rights, what they do. I think that some of those misconceptions stem from the fact that we hear Miranda rights all the time now because it's cop TV shows, these are different shows. But just because you hear something all the time doesn't mean you actually understand it. It just means that you've heard it. So research has shown that people who are involved in the juvenile justice system, which means that they do some research with people who are in jails and do some research with people in the community, both groups, community and people involved in the juvenile justice system or in the adult system, have misconceptions, such as they'll believe that if you assert your right to silence, you're really saying you're guilty. That's not what that right is about. And that misconception reflects, I think, their failure to appreciate how that information they give will be used in court. Another misconception that research has demonstrated that kids and adults, unfortunately, have is that if you ask for an attorney, you're also saying, in fact, you're guilty. And that's a misconception because it shows a failure to appreciate how the attorney can, in fact, protect your rights and how they are knowledgeable of this legal system. So those are two concrete examples that research has shown about misconceptions of Miranda rights.
Is there anything we should be paying particular attention to when it comes to youth and Miranda?
Well, one of the things is that we know that youth, more so than adults, are more oriented toward immediate rewards and what's happening right now, and their future orientation is far more narrow than that of an adult. So they can't appreciate the consequences. They are more attuned to what's going to be the short-term goal and wanting that. So therefore, the short-term goal could be for an adolescent or youth, I want to talk so I can go home. And in that, there is a failure to appreciate what is the long-term consequence of that information that you might provide to the police. And so that specifically represents a developmental difference. Also, research is pretty consistent that adolescents, more so than their adult counterparts, are more impulsive. So therefore, they're more likely just to say, yeah, I understand my rights, without really giving them thought and actually considering what are the consequences of waiving those rights.
So what other factors may contribute to unreliable confessions? Because what you just explained, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that sort of this lack of comprehension of maybe the meaning and function of Miranda leads to behaviors for kids of like not asking for attorneys or choosing not to remain silent, which in the end can lead to some of these issues. Are there other factors that contribute to unreliable confessions?
Yes, there are. Some of those factors have to do with the characteristic of a person, and some of them have to do with the characteristic of the situation. So I'm going to handle those sort of in two separate So characteristics of a person that can contribute to make them more likely to provide a false or unreliable confession are their intelligence, really sort of their cognitive, their ability to cognitively make choices and to be able to understand how truthful is it when this police officer tells me he's going to help me or this is in my best interest to do this. Other things, being vulnerable to the pressure of an adult authority figure, adolescents are more vulnerable to that than adults, especially when they're in an interrogative situation, so they have no one else to rely upon to help them make a choice other than that one adult or the two authority figure, meaning the two sort of police or detectives in the room. Other things that could impact this as well are if a person has a learning disability, and we know that a large percent of kids in the juvenile justice system have learning disabilities, and similarly, having a mental health issue could also make one more vulnerable to providing a false confession. So those are factors sort of having to do with the individual. Factors that have to do with the situation are things like the length of the interrogation. And so often, and it's interesting because depending upon what research you look at, it's sort of the idea is anything over 6 hours should make you pause and think that interrogation could have gone on too long. Well, typically that's how it would be for a adult and not an adolescent. So one that leads you to believe that for it shouldn't even be that long for an adolescent to make you think, I wonder what's going on here. I wonder if this confession is reliable. Other things are the tactics that the police use. Adolescents can be more vulnerable to these tactics because an adolescent is more likely to rely on them and see them as being truthful, or more likely to be able to figure out how the police may be telling them one side and how what the police may be telling them, the likelihood of that being true are not great frequently. And I've seen this on videotapes where the police say, we're going to let you go home, you know, if you tell us that you did this crime. Well, because kids are concerned about what happens right then and there and the immediate consequence, they think, good, you get to go home. And the police, they let them go home, but the next day they come and arrest them because of what they said. So there's a not even really a longer-term consequence in that example, but there's consequence that's beyond the window of what the child is concerned with. So the police tactics are something that is another area that one needs to consider in producing, increasing the likelihood that the confession is false. Also, some of the techniques the police use, such as minimization, where they try to minimize the impact. Oh, you didn't really mean this. This was an accident. I've done things like this before. I've gotten myself in problems, but we can get out of it, that sort of thing. So different kinds of tactics. Using false evidence is another technique that the police use that make adolescents are particularly vulnerable because, again, they really don't have, because of their psychosocial maturity, sometimes it can be hard for them to discern how accurate, how truthful is this evidence or this so-called evidence the police are giving me. Can it really be used in court? And some of these things, quite frankly, some adults would have difficulty discerning the accuracy of that. That's why it's important to have attorneys there in the room to help the person who's being interviewed make these judgments.
Great. I just want to remind our listeners that they can call in live on air and ask you a question, and that phone number is 347-994-1149, and you will press the number one on your telephone keypad. You indicated, you know, that you have seen videotapes. One thing that you do is assess confessions. And so I wanted to know if you could share a few more stories, some real-life examples of what you've seen, because we always hear how could it be true that anyone would actually confess to something that they did not do. So I believe that stories can really help people understand.
I think that I think stories are very good. So I'm going to give you a story about an adult who I think many people could relate to, and I'm going to give you a story having to do with kids. I interviewed this man probably in his 40s who signed confessions saying that he set a series of fires. And his confessions were written, and they said things like, I don't really remember if I did this fire, but here's how I think I would have done it. I was blacked out at the time, and there were like 5 different separate fires that he confessed to. Now, what happened, there were a series of things that contributed to this, and internal things having to do with him and things having to do with the situation. Things having to do with him were included. He had a drinking problem, and he was up. He had not slept. He'd been up all night drinking when the police came to talk to him. They came to talk to him because he decided to burn his beer cans, and that's how this whole started. And he acknowledges, I burnt the beer cans. So we had one thing, which is his drinking history, which is a mental health issue. Another thing was that he was taking psychotropic medications prescribed by a psychiatrist. He had not had his dosage because of when the police came. The police, so those are two sort of characteristics of the person. They interrogated him over a 10-hour period, not every moment, but it was a very long interrogation, especially given that he had not slept, he had these unmet mental health needs. Now, some of the techniques that were used is the police told him things like, we have you on videotape. We have you on videotape driving up to a gas station, filling a container full of gas, and then going to this house to set this fire. And they told him how he was supposed to set the fire. And he said in that moment, he was very clear, at first I didn't believe him. I knew that it couldn't be so. I knew that I didn't do it. But the more they said it and the longer it went on, the more I thought, well, I know I drank, so maybe this did happen and I just don't remember. So you had this period of him feeling, and also he felt very, he talked about feeling very isolated, like no one could help him. And so he was getting all of his source of information from the police. And over time, that really caused him to doubt himself. And this was a educated man. He had a master's degree. He ran his own business. So he was a very educated man. I think that's similar to a lot of people, and you can find yourself in this situation. I have seen tapes of and interviewed kids who confess to things, and in part, what happens is they said, well, my parent told me to talk. And I interviewed the parent, and the parent said, yes, I told him to talk. Two things that have happened frequently. The kid says, I didn't do it, and be that true or not, I don't know. So the parent says, well, since he didn't do it, what's wrong with him talking? Again, we see that misconception happen. I've had other instances where, because of the parent's own issues, like they have to get to work, like they have a mental health problem and need to go address that, they tell their kids things like, you need to talk now, I need to go. So again, there's this conflict of interest used in a very non-legal way of whose interest is more important here while this kid is in the station, the parents or the kid. And if the parent is telling them they have to talk, even if you have a kid who rarely listens to their parent, in a time of stress, they're more likely to listen to them and do what they say. So you have that. In that situation, it's almost as if the parent and the police are telling the kid to talk. So now you have yet another source of authority that this kid has to fend with. And fortunately, there aren't many kids who are going to be able to resist that. And so I've seen those types of things. Those are examples of cases that I've had.
We did have a question from a listener that they've heard this term suggestibility,
mm-hmm.
And if you could explain what that means.
Okay, I'm assuming they mean interrogative suggestibility, and it's a mm-hmm. term that means Good Johnson is the person who developed a test for that and developed this theory of interrogative suggestibility, but in essence what it means is that because of the way the questions are posed, that's the only source of information that you have. And the questions are posed in a manner that would allow you to endorse one of them. So that's one element, which means that you have a very limited information and you accept that which is given. So that's one element of interrogative suggestibility. The other element is that because it's an enclosed environment, you're also more likely to change your response based upon the feedback. So what you see is, for example, you were there, you know, the police say things where they make it clear what your answer should be. So that would be how interrogative suggestibility happens. Or they think, no, that wasn't it. That's not what happened, is it? And the person says, yes, I'm telling you what happened. No, you're not. And interrogative suggestibility assesses the likelihood that you change your answer in response to this negative feedback. I hope that clarifies it.
Thank you. That's good. So
and I should say, too, that sure. I'm sorry, because with this interrogative suggestibility, mm-hmm. empirically what we know is that kids are more vulnerable, have greater level of interrogative suggestibility, as do people with lower IQ. So this is an area where, again, kids are more vulnerable for having this, for this, and this leads to a greater likelihood of there being an unreliable confession.
We didn't really talk about this, but are there studies or things that indicate the rates of false or coerced confessions? Have there been studies that people can look to?
Well, for example, Leo and Drizin reviewed some DNA-proven false confessions, And so what, and in this review of them, what they found is that kids are kids, meaning those who committed the offense prior to age 18, are disproportionately represented at higher rates. And this speaks to the vulnerability that of kids to providing false confessions.
Well, you were starting to talk about certain things that contributed to false and coerced confessions, sort of like the length of interrogations and the other methodology that law enforcement uses. So let's flip it. What can we do to reduce the amount of unreliable confessions and wrongful convictions?
I think that one thing that could happen or that could help reduce it is videotaping not just the interrogation but the questioning. I think that in the examples of videotaping and not just electronic recording, which is just the voice, because it's often important to see what goes on, not just hear it, because you can't hear, there are things that you can't hear and that you seeing it makes it more relevant. Some jurisdictions, though, just require that the confession be videotaped and not what led up to it. And often what led up to it is a lot of questioning and seeing how things change, see how a person becomes despondent, that sort of thing. You don't get that if you only do the confession. So I think that one thing that could reduce the rate of false confessions is to videotape from really the moment the police begin to have contact with the suspect through when the confession is obtained. Also for youth in particular, I think that requiring a parent be present is simply not enough. Parents are sometimes not very knowledgeable about the rights and how to protect their child. They might have conflicts of interest. So I think that although I recognize that in this fiscal day and age, it's going to be a difficult thing, but something that would certainly help given the liberty issues at stake are to actually have an attorney present and not appoint an attorney subsequent, but to have an attorney present when the kid is being questioned. Also, I want to backtrack about the videotape. There's also literature that talks about the impact of the videotape angle, the angle of the video picture, whether or not you're actually seeing both the detective's face and the suspect's face. So I would encourage the jurisdictions that are thinking about that. I know, for example, the American Bar Association has put out a thing saying videotape interrogations and confessions. And whenever I see those position papers, I'm also looking for a paragraph or something that talks about it matters how it's done, not just that it's done. Because there is research that says the angle of the camera impacts people's perception of whether or not there's coercion. So that really does matter. And I think it matters, too, when you consider that we also know empirically that when a confession is obtained and entered into evidence, jurors give it a lot of weight. So it matters.
Often when we talk about juvenile justice, the issue of race comes up, especially disproportionate representation. So is there a role of racial bias in any of this?
You know, there are theoretical papers about it, but it's not been empirically looked at. And some of the theoretical papers talk about how because of racial stereotyping, perhaps what goes on in the room as well is that since police often believe they've been trained to discern when a person is lying, although when you look at the efficacy of that training, it's not very good and it's as good as a guess. But police believe they can do it. Research has shown that, and police believe they are successful at it. So there are some theoretical papers that talk about, well, maybe what goes on in a cross-racial dyad or racial stereotyping that's happening so that police are even more so than with a person who's not of color, misreading the cues and seeing the person is lying when, in fact, they aren't, and that contributes, seeing the person is lying when they say, I didn't do it, and the police continue to use their tactics and use them more so, and that may contribute to the disproportionate representation in this area. I hope that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So you are a trained evaluator and you assess confessions. Perhaps you can explain what that even means, but how can courts utilize professionals like you?
Okay. I want to be clear that I don't assess whether or not a person did it or didn't do it. Like, I have no crystal ball. But things that I and other forensic evaluators can assist with is, first, with a disputed confession, because usually we are asked to come in at a point where it's not determined by DNA evidence or some other source that the confession is false. So I think that when we come in, it's really in the arena of disputed confessions that may later be determined to be false. But so, and that kind of evaluation starts with, did you understand your Miranda rights? Were you really able to make a knowing and intelligent and voluntary waiver? And that happens by going through the person with the version of rights they were given and seeing how they understood them. We know that there are many different versions of rights across the country. Some require a third grade level of understanding. Some require post-high school level of understanding. So there's a great variety. So doing an assessment of their ability to understand their Miranda rights, and then doing an assessment of what went on in the room and to what degree in the interrogation room and to what degree are there sort of red flags about the individual and about the circumstances and the tactics that would lead one to believe that this could be an unreliable confession. And looking for those things based upon the literature and based upon interview data and test data of the individual. So that's how you do those assessments.
So as someone who likes concrete sometimes,
uh-huh.
if
what
I was...
Really
a, yeah. Well, as an attorney, if I am representing a youth, what should I specifically be looking for? Because you're talking about what went on in the interview room. What are some things that perhaps before I would even request or say this may be a disputed confession? So, if, you know, what are some clear things to be looking for?
Okay, so clear things to be looking for to do for attorneys. Don't just ask your clients, did you understand your rights or not, which is that's what the police do. And you get a yes, no, you don't know if that really reflects an understanding. And most people are going to say, yes, they understood something, instead of making themselves appear vulnerable and telling you that they don't. So instead say, tell me what at the time you thought your rights meant when they went, and then you can see how accurate that is and how much it reflects an understanding. If a lawyer thinks that that's significantly off, and I think that they should request an evaluation. I do not think in any way that they should try to correct the wrong and educate them about what their rights really mean, because that taints it for the evaluator. So I want to be clear on that. So you can ask the client to explain what their rights meant, and then you can see if, in fact, they understand them or which of them they understand. You can ask them to explain what went on in the room, so that you can see another technique that police often use are minimizing the importance of the rights by saying things like, my boss just makes me say this, I just have to get it over with. Well, it's not really their boss unless they work for the Supreme Court, and it's not something you just have to get over with. It's actually something that's very important, but they minimize the importance. So really going through with your client what went on in that room, well, I think, and how they felt as they made choices and why they made choices, can help the attorney gather information to use to demonstrate that they need the evaluation and to consider whether or not they need the evaluation. So really spending some time talking to the client about what went on in the room.
Okay. And maybe in this line of concreteness, what are some of the best practices for law enforcement when training, thinking about questioning youth, and what are the differences between questioning youth and adults? You've talked about them generally, but I'd like to get more specific.
Well, if I had my druthers,
yes.
I think that law enforcement should have to ask, this exchange should be videotaped, have to ask a youth to, once they tell them the warning, instead of saying, do you understand, say, tell me what that means. And so that, because that way the law enforcement and subsequently the judge has more information to make a decision on. by having you actually verbalize that. Now, what's important is, in my brothers, you would also start the videotape as soon as you had contact with the youth. So therefore, anyone gets to see on tape whether or not you've explained it to them, where their version, when the youth gets to say what they think the warning means, where that came from. So I think that's an important thing. I think if I could, you know, wave a wand, I would have law enforcement say periodically, do you want to keep talking to me? Because I think what happens is you give the Miranda warning in the beginning, the person starts talking, and they forget. I have the right to say, okay, I've had enough. I don't want to talk to you anymore. So I think that, and similarly, to remind them, okay, we're going to keep going. I just want to make sure to see, do you want to keep talking to me? Do you want a lawyer? Those sorts of things. So I think that those are some concrete things that law enforcement could do. If I had my magic wand, I would also say that law enforcement should not use false evidence with youth. Law enforcement could not use techniques of saying or getting polygraph tests with youth. I think those things are problematic with adults as well, but for our topic today, I think they're particularly problematic with youth. So those are some things that I think that law enforcement should do differently with interrogations, in addition to the things that I've mentioned before, such as videotaping the entire time that they're with a person. I actually think if you're going to redo the system, you would also not have such a small room where the person of authority is often in a chair that, for some mysterious reason, happens to be taller than the youth chair. Where they're so confined, I think that all contributes to increasing the anxiety of the person and thereby their stress and making it more likely that they could give an unreliable confession. So those are some things that I would do differently.
Great. We have another question wanting to know, is there a particular age range where children are more susceptible to be pressured into a false confession? And maybe also I'd like to add, is there anything about a relation to severity of crime with that?
Okay, I don't know the literature with relationship to severity of crime, so that's my empirical thing, anecdotal. I'm always amazed when kids, and I have this happen, unfortunately, more frequently than not, where a kid thinks, once I tell them what they want to hear, which is that I did this horrible crime, they're going to let me go home. So, again, kids frequently believe that to be the case, I think. And what happens is the kid is just concerned about going home, and that meaning worried about the being concerned with immediate rewards, which is going home, is a very normative process. Having a truncated future orientation is normal. So when you take these normal things, what's not normal is to be able to weigh really, what's the likelihood of them being able to let you go home once you said you did X, Y, and Z? And the kids will often say, well, when I said I had marijuana, they let me go home. They can't even accurately weigh the different variables in this situation frequently. That's been my experience. So I don't know research about with the severity, but I can tell you what I have experienced based upon my years of doing this. And what was the first part of the question? I'm sorry.
It pertained to the age of children and if there was an age range where they are also where they're more susceptible to coerced or false confessions.
Well, the literature, for example, with Drizzo and Drizzen and Leo does show that there's an age range such that younger kids are more vulnerable. However, what I think, so we know that based upon the literature. But I think that I want to be really clear in this. We don't know the true rate of false confessions, clearly, okay? We just know things where it's been discovered that it was false, so it's likely to be larger or higher than what we know. Also, when we look at vulnerability to peer pressure or to adult pressure in research, those which they show that children or adolescents are more vulnerable to adults, those research do not replicate the circumstances of an interrogation for obvious reasons. But what we know from like regulative studies is that younger kids are more vulnerable. For example, 10 to 14, I think she found in one study, than their more older adolescent counterparts in a lab study. And I think that's important to keep in mind, that it's a lab study and not with police officers and in the same, it doesn't reproduce the same stress and anxiety that a real interrogation does, comes with. Did I lose you again?
No, you didn't.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
No. Yeah, I can.
Well, I do want to tell our audience that Dr. Kavanaugh is on the road right now. And so, again, Internet, we really appreciate you calling in. So despite some technical difficulties, what I was asking is that for our audience that wants to learn more about these issues, whether it be brain science or unreliable confessions, what are some resources that you can point them to?
Well, I would I would point you to a couple of things. Steinberg, Larry Steinberg, Beth Kaufman, those are some of the researchers that have researched adolescent development issues, such as having to do with the psychosocial immaturity, the increased sensation-seeking in adolescents, risk perception, the impulsivity of adolescents, that sort of thing, and the resistance to peer pressure. So Larry Steinberg is a great resource. Regarding false confessions, the phenomena in general, and how it pertains, and how being a youth puts one at risk, the American Psychology and Law Society came out with a position paper on false confessions, and you can find that on the website, and that is authored by many people. So that's on the website, and I think that that's an important thing because it's only the second position paper that the APA, the American Psychology and Law Society, which is a division of the American Psychological Association, has put out. The other position paper was on eyewitness identification and gathering that literature together to make it coherent. So that's something. Something about risk-taking, something that I find very readable, which is the Science of Adolescent Risk-Taking, and that's the National Academies Press, which you can get, you can download on the PDF. The National Academy Press is a really good resource, because it's funded by the government, it has a lot of weight to it, and it usually brings together in a really consolidated way a lot of the literature and where we are with things. So those are some resources.
Terrific. And I know we have posted some of those that you sent over at Children's Law's website. So final thoughts about this issue, what you want our listeners to know, maybe as a community, things that we should be keeping in mind as we move forward in looking at the juvenile justice system, how we keep kids out of it, but also for those who do need some intervention, what we can be doing better.
Well, let's see. So a final thought I have for the people who could help change laws and make laws. This idea of you didn't have to actually be the one to pull the trigger, but you could have been there, makes you as accountable as the person who pulled the trigger. I think that logic is really faulty when you apply it to an adolescent. And I hope that with the wording in Miller and with the literature that we know about brain development, that legislatures around the country will take a look at that and realize that it's not all that applicable to adolescents. So that's one thought. Another final thought I have is that I really hope that the people who work daily with adolescents can be more cognizant of the what the literature tells us about how the adolescent brain functions in comparison to the adult brain, so that we can be more patient with adolescents and help, and that because we should have then a better understanding of why they might make some of the decisions that they make. I think also another final thought is that when we think about how the adolescent's sometimes inability because of brain functioning to resist peer pressure, that might help us rethink some of the things that the probation officers ask them to do and that the judges ask adolescents to do, and it would help the adults to think, really, am I setting them up for failure? Of course, while they're with me and none of their friends are around, they tell me, yes, I can do this. But because we know what's developmentally normal about their ability to resist peer pressure, we, the adults, are setting kids up for failure. And I think that frequently happens, and the collateral consequence of that failure is really great for a lot of kids. So those are some of my final thoughts.
Thank you so much again for taking the time to be with us here today. Our next show will focus on the Defending Childhood Initiative, and we'll feature the acting director of OJJDP and a lead technical assistance provider from Futures Without Violence. To stay informed about upcoming shows, you can either follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or visit the Children's Law Center's website at www.childrenslawky.org. You'll also find the resources we discussed posted here today. Take care and see you next time on Spotlight on Youth. Thank you, Antoinette.
Thank you for having me. Have a good day.